see in a clapboard shack by a broken down tree.
There's a light in the window, just salty gals inside.
I'm not sure if they're witches, but you know that's implied.
Got the storytelling ego swelling,
pillow talking, moonlight walking sea hags.
Welcome to the Sea Hags Podcast. My name is Chris Jeffa.
And I'm Katie Norgan. With us this week is one cute mama, a game maker.
A bread maker.
A homeschooler.
A radical psychologist? Like, counselor?
A researcher.
Community developer.
A feeder of all.
Oh, yeah. And just an all-around wonderful person.
Ms. Avery Alder is here.
Hi.
Welcome. Our shanty shack down by the sea. It's a beautiful spring day today. I actually found crocuses in my yard for the first time, which is really exciting.
Wait, those are flowers, right?
Yeah. Oh,
okay. I heard crooks. You found some bandits in your yard or something.
It's spring and the crooks are out.
Yeah, I just...
Looting gardens.
I sort of... My brain filled in all of the bad guys from DuckTales that just wore striped shirts all the time and bandit masks.
That's a pretty, like dead giveaway, you guys.
It's like, my brain leapt to raccoons somehow, that you had raccoons in your yard.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of beautiful flowers.
Yeah, well, I did have a guy get out of his car, walk into my backyard, stand in my vegetable garden, and then pee on the hedge, and then get back into his car.
What?
And drive away.
What?
Yeah, so that was fun. So I guess there's been some crooks in my garden.
Some public urinators.
Yeah.
That's
and then,
rude.
That wasn't even the only person this week. There was also, like, a little old man did the same.
You caught two people peeing in your yard?
Yeah,
this week?
We didn't yell
like
at him
on the inside of the hedge.
Yeah. Because they think, like, oh, then no one will see me from the road. But it's like, don't do that, please.
Oh, my God. Do it in a bottle in your car like a civilized person. I'm just kidding. Don't do that. Go in bathrooms if you are able.
Yeah, we're just like, I don't know. You can pee in the woods and stuff, but like people's yards are, it's a little bit rude.
I can't say I've ever peed in someone's yard except for mine when I was a child. I was very good at it.
I don't know.
Anybody else done any peeing in any yards lately?
I feel like I've peed in a lot of yards, but they're always like my friend's yard at a party. Like, yeah. I'm invited into the yard before
like
peeing there. I feel
count
like that's
as much.
It's like vampire rules.
Vampire rules. You're invited in, you get to pee as much as you want.
Vampire.
I hate you. I love you.
I'm actually reading the best vampire book right now. Oh my God. It's
what
so
it?
Spooky. Okay. It's called The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. Mm. And it's very much, she's like, oh, these stories that I got from my dad. And it's all these like series of like letters and journal entries, and it just like goes back and back in time, and basically they're following the trail of like Vlad Tepes, like the Dracula man.
Pokerman.
Yeah.
Vlad Pokerman, I believe his name was.
The Impalerman. And it just like gets so spooky because they're like everywhere they go, if they start researching like this book, then it's like certainly like they start feeling like they're under surveillance and they're getting like chased around like Istanbul and like they're in like behind the Iron Curtain, like Soviet, like in Hungary and Bulgaria and like all kinds of stuff.
Those are the most vampiric countries.
Yeah, and Romania.
Well,
that's
the most.
Those are the ones.
That's the maximum amount of vampirism.
And it really
per
like
capita.
It really like brought the connection between like Istanbul and like that whole area of like Eastern Europe where there was like all that fighting between the Ottomans and like the Byzantines and all of this kind of stuff. And so they're digging back into that history, but it's like Ooh. So spooky because it's like anyone that researches this and starts getting interested in it starts getting followed.
Why, this so, mosaic looks like a vampire.
Well, so then I'm reading this book in a restaurant and these two men in like big black suits sit down and start speaking in an Eastern European language. And I'm like, oh no,
they found you.
By me reading the book, have I like opened like another level of this?
You're in
like,
too deep, Chris.
I was really kind of spooked, and then I'm like, Chris, not all Eastern Europeans
are vampires or vampire hunters.
But I did ask them, I was like, excuse me, what language are you speaking? Because I wanted to know, and they're like, oh, they said Slavonic. Oh. And I was just like, oh, cool, like, because my dad's Polish and blah, blah, blah. And so I got into a conversation, but I'm like, okay, good, they're not from Bulgaria. Just in case.
Just in case.
No. So anyway, so I've been really enjoying reading that book. And it's been, I've not had my headphones in a lot. I've been reading books in cafes again,
right.
Picking up on great conversation, listening to really good music, and just feeling, like, very inspired. So
oh, fantastic.
I feel like I'm having a personal, like, spring.
Right yeah. Now. This whole week you've been very up and creative and peppy.
I've been feeling a lot more like my old self kind of thing. I was very sad for a while and, like, feeling lots of feels and kind of feeling, like, muted out, you know? And so I feel like a part of me that was like gone dormant is like now coming back out. So
that's safe. It makes that's me very really springy. Happy. Very springy.
I've been feeling the same. About 2 weeks ago, I feel like I suddenly became a human again.
Oh, after good.
After months and months of being
super sick.
Like a bed creature, yeah.
A
bed gerblin.
Yeah, well, just like November was really chaotic and like and difficult emotionally for me. And I came out of it like the start of December, I was like, okay, things are okay again. But then I had like a big surgery on December 12th.
Right.
And then surgery complications just came up. I was like told like, oh, like 2 or 3 days, you'll be back up at your regular routine. And then like I get the surgery and then I'm like, before I leave the hospital, they're like, by the way, just like for the next month, don't pick up anything heavier than like 5, 10 pounds,
oh,
you know?
No.
And I'm like, oh, like my baby. And they're like, yeah, like don't touch your baby. And
don't even touch your baby.
Don't even look at your baby. That's how heavy.
Look at your baby. Bad things are going to happen to you specifically.
But I ended up being in bed for like 2 months with surgery complications.
That's awesome.
And it was just like, it took so long to like get back to a place where I was like feeling like I don't know. Some people are good, I think, at being, at spending like a lot longer at their house. But like, I like crave being at home, but the moment that I'm there for like more than like 2 or 3 days without like switching it up, I start to
just lose it. Variety in life. Definitely.
Yeah. And you're one of the more social folks that I know, so it's like to actually be able to go out and meet with people and all of that as well is like.
Were you holding court at all from your bed throne?
I tried to. Well, the first week, I'm always trying to hold court from my bedroom, from my bed. That's the ideal life. But,
just velvet pillows everywhere. Some pearls, like, woven into your hair.
Yeah. Teaching my children to bring me grapes and drop them in
a
my mouth one
you with,
at a
like,
time.
An ostrich fan.
You've got it. You've got
That's
it.
That's why you have kids. Why not, if not that? To act as, like, Egyptian servants, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, ancient, sorry. Like, I believe the word that you're looking for is slavery.
So let's pull back from that joke. But no, for the first week, I did have people coming over every night to, like, cook dinner for the family and sit with me by my bed. Because that's about how long the doctors told me I might theoretically need people for.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, just be safe. I'll book all 8 days.
8 days a week?
8 days of the week. You're familiar with the week, yeah.
Yep.
Slurs Day.
We're on Beatles time.
I've heard the song, yeah.
But after that, I didn't set anything up because I was told that I definitely wouldn't need it. Doctors are always giving people optimistic timelines, and I think that's a terrible idea.
They should really, like, prepare you for the worst.
Like, don't
tell
people
the
best case scenario. Like, at best, they're going to feel like neutral about it. And at worst, you're going to, like, totally fuck up their life for a few months by not giving them the tools they need. Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
So, no, there was, like, months that went by where I didn't really see anybody, but...
Sucks.
It sucks.
Yeah, isolation's not a good feeling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a good highlighter on other feelings.
Yeah, I think that's too, like, the spending a long time isolated in your bedroom, not receiving the care you need, like, leads you to think that you don't deserve care.
Right.
So then you don't ask for it. And then it's just, like, a vicious cycle, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. And you end up in your sweat cave just staring at the internet, if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. and at the wall, if you're not.
Ooh, God.
Sweat cave. Yeah, that's how I feel when I'm in bed for more than a couple of days, for sure.
Yeah.
Or even 12 hours. It's about when I start getting cabin fever.
Yeah. A friend of mine was recovering from a concussion and just, like, couldn't even look at screens or books or anything and just had to, like, stare at the wall, so...
That stinks. You get really caught up in your podcast at that point, probably.
I guess, that's a good call, yeah.
That's what I did after I got my... I almost said I got my eyes taken out. I conflated my laser eye surgery with my wisdom teeth surgery. You know, when I had my eyes out, I had to
eyes.
When I had my wisdom eyes and my baby eyes had to be taken out so my adult eyes could come in.
That's such a terrifying image.
Yeah, creating an alternate universe of horror, of like John Carpenter.
And there's just like, all of us are born with another set of eyes, like up inside of our heads, just waiting all the time.
I have body horror feelings from that. That's awful. I had laser eye surgery. That was when I still lived with my ex-boyfriend, who was like, I don't think you can take care of me while this is happening. So I just went to my parents' house after my mom babied me for like 4 days. But yeah, mm-hmm. I couldn't look at any screen. So I just had to listen to like books on tape, because that was before I knew what a podcast was in 2010.
Oh God.
The year of our Lord, 2010.
Were those ever the days?
Yes, I was taken home from my laser eye surgery in a horse and buggy. I use very primitive lasers. That's what happened.
Someone just held a candle up to your eyes.
I'm like, let's hope for the best. Hope you can see better after we do this horrible thing to you. Anyway, yeah. So, it's good to have someone to look after you, but it's very hard to ask people to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How was your week, Katie?
Better than previous weeks, actually. Yeah, I got, my drugs got bumped. So, my antidepressants
bumped up.
Yeah.
We were joking about how, like, the world is kind of awful, and so, like, your SSRIs and the world are, like, fighting neck and neck to see who's, like, gonna win out. Yeah. So it's
who's
like,
the gonna win?
Mario Kart for mental health.
Yeah, exactly. I need a blue shell to knock all these other fuckers who are doing better than me out of the way. No, I suddenly, all the motivation that I was having just disappeared. Like, for some reason, normally November is my very depressed month, but November and December were pretty ballin' for me, just because, like, I was on that serotonin high. I was getting stuff done, and I had energy for the first time, but that just, like, dipped after the whole, you know, stuff in the south of us that's bad, because I keep paying attention to it and can't do anything, really. Mm-hmm. So that helplessness is making me feel really demotivated, and I just haven't felt like doing anything creatively. So I was like, this is how I'm feeling. My doctor's like, let's just see what happens if we bump you up. And suddenly, like, yeah, I'm feeling much better again, but I'm still so fatigued, because every time I take it, it just makes, every time I bump it up, it makes me really dizzy for like a week or two. So I'm just like, today, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's okay. I don't have to be the smartest, most eloquent person in the room, because you two are here, so we should be fine. So I'm doing good, or doing well, if you like, but I've been really slacking on doing stand-up, and I feel kind of bad about it, so I really need to get back to it.
Yeah, there's a big comedy festival in town all week. And
serious imposter syndrome. I didn't want to go out and do stuff, because I just, like,
because some of the big names were hanging out at all the open mics and stuff, and it, like,
but also just, like, the people who've been doing it even for a year or two longer are just more invested in the idea of them being comics, and they're more exclusionary right now. Like, they're more like, this is the best time of the year, I'm just, like, on my game, and this is, like, what real comedy's all about, and people are making declarations, and I'm just like, well, I'm shit, so I'm staying home. It's just sad.
Yeah.
I don't actually believe it, but that's how I was feeling.
Yeah. You definitely deserve to be up there, though.
Thank you. I had a decent set at my own show, so that was good. That was, like, the only good set I've had in the last 2 months, so. But okay, other than that, I'm good. I'm good. How are you, Avery?
I'm good, yeah.
Can I pour you some tea right now?
Yeah, I would be even more good.
Chamomile citrus.
That sounds delightful. Yeah.
Sometimes we have, like, the nice onomatopoeia of the tea, like, pouring. That's actually, onomatopoeia would be if I went.
Poor.
Sploosh. Yes, I realize.
Fully. I love you. Just thought I'd say that.
Yay. Love you too. Anyway.
Aw, precious moment.
Yeah.
My week's been really good. Yeah. Today, I went to Quaker meeting. There's two different Quaker meetings I go to, and this is the one that's, like, it starts with, like, a shared breakfast where everyone brings stuff.
Do you have
and
oats?
Then we
do you eat Quaker oats at the Quaker breakfast?
Wow, we're just okay.
Avery's like, I came here for a nice chat and I feel so attacked right now.
We told you there'd be goofs, Avery. We warned you about the goofs. You should have come goof prepared.
I did have an oat muffin, a very oat-leading muffin.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
there you go.
Guilty as charged. But no, this one's really good, actually.
That's great.
We have, like, breakfast together, and then, like, set up chairs in a circle and, like, pile pillows in the middle of the circle.
Oh.
And all the children just sit there cross-legged and read. And so they're all reading books, and because it's, like, I don't know, like, some of them, like, brought, like Bria brought a dinosaur book from home, but then a bunch of them are reading, like, comics about labor history and indigenous struggle in the area.
Oh my
because
goodness.
These are, like, Quakers, and they're like, we're gonna have, like, this wholesome gallery of children's books that also has, like, a bunch of, like,
consciousness-raising.
Anarchist consciousness-raising stuff just slipped in there.
A's for activist
options.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's a real book.
It is, yeah.
That's really sweet.
Yeah, it was really nice.
I really like Quaker philosophy a lot.
Me
it
too.
All just seems so kind and so, like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know much about it, but I just know, like, friends that have gone to, like, a Quaker school or something, and just like, oh, like, you have such a, like, great foundation for like, empathy to other humans, which is the most important thing.
I think I've been really struggling with, though, is that the Vancouver Quaker meetings are quite white and quite, like, upper middle class. And I think there's, like, the tension of, like, wanting to go to Quaker meetings because, like, there is this, like, activist lineage embedded within that, like, faith practice that includes, like, slavery abolition and, like, war resistance and, like, really important stuff. That seems like sometimes it's... I don't know, this is actually something that I, like, spoke about in meeting today, but I think that there's an insidious trend over the last few decades of, like, shrinking the boundaries of what counts as nonviolence and shrinking it to mean non-hostility and non-confrontationalness in a lot of cases. And a lot of people, like, talking about protests, especially, like, things like Black Lives Matter tactics, being like, well, this should have been a non-violent protest, like, but windows were smashed. And this should have been a nonviolent protest, but highways were shut down and people couldn't get to work. And this should have been a nonviolent protest, but people, like, fought back when the cops, like, literally physically attacked them. And it's like, it's just like, all nonviolence. That's like, that's literally what nonviolence is. Like, it's where you aggressively and confrontationally
hold the line.
Hold the line, and where you refuse to use, like, you refuse to punch and kill people. But, like, nonviolence only works, you know, if you bring fire and anger to it.
Wow. And it's not just passivity. Yeah. And it's not just being like, okay, well, I guess we're just not going to worry about that. And we'll just, like, take care of each other in our nice ways. Like, that's a nice part of it. But it's like, you also need to, like, do some serious resistance as well.
Exactly, yeah.
So it sounds like there was, like, a creep of respectability politics that came into it.
Yeah, I think that's, like, a thing that's going on in a lot of... liberal discourse, especially white liberal discourse, in the world that we're in.
Simplicity of don't fight hate with hate, or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. And so that was the thing I was thinking about a lot the last time I was at this Quaker meeting, and this time, so it's like a silent, it's like what's called waiting worship, where everyone just sits in silence together and, like, looks for the truth in that silence, and sometimes people feel compelled by the spirit, they say, to speak. And I ended up feeling compelled to speak about nonviolence and, like, the necessity of nonviolence, meaning, like, resisting cops, resisting violence, smashing property. Like, these things need to be part of nonviolence, otherwise it won't work.
Absolutely.
Which I think resonated really strongly with some people, and definitely did not with other people.
Challenged some other people.
Yeah, exactly.
And then is there a discussion, or is it usually, like, you would say your piece and then the people would just sit and, like, think about that kind of in silence? Well, that's kind of nice, because then it's, like, you don't get into necessarily, like, people have time instead of just immediately reacting. They're like, oh, you actually have to sit with that for a bit and think about what that means to you and then have something thoughtful to say about it later.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, like, the sitting in silence thing, because when someone... when somebody says something, you can't argue back with it. Like, you need to sit with it. And I think that that's, like, it's not just, like, mulling it over in your head, but it's actually just contending with the fact that you'll never be in a room of people where you agree with everyone. And just, like, fully coming to terms with that, I think is important.
It's like, I don't have the opportunity to try to change someone's mind right now. I just have to sit and listen to what they feel and think. And so I just have to accept that that's how they are.
I do too. It's something that's always interested me. Both Quaker philosophies and, like, Unitarian ones have always been. And it's something that I struggle with in my relationship, actually, because my partner is very, extremely atheistic. And I'm not. Like, I was very, like, quite religious as a teenager. I don't know why, but I was just, like, pulled towards church. Never had any basis for that in my family, but it was something that really pulled me in for a long time. And then having left it, there are things that I miss about it a lot. And there are, like, having a spiritual side is something that I'm not comfortable talking about very often, because, like, it's really denigrated. Like, even in humanistic circles, they're just like, well,
I mean, God's not real, so religion's poison and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, I feel like the search for that, like, for your own kind of truth and for your own connection to a spiritual side of things is really, like, not respected in more sort of rational circles. I'm doing, like, big air quotes here. But you know the kind of thing I'm talking about, right? Like, the that sense of kind of intellectual superiority if mm-hmm. you don't have a spiritual practice or a spiritual association. And I think that the idea that, like, oh, you're somehow freer or better because you don't have that is pervasive. I don't know if you guys would agree with that, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that definitely I grew up, like, not religious. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes struggle to make meaning out of the events going on in my life mm-hmm. and struggle to find motivation. And I think that, like, being anti-capitalist, wanting to work to, like, betray whiteness rather yeah. than being complicit in it, and being queer, like, opts me out of a lot of frameworks for understanding how to, like, find motivation when I'm not in a place to, like, self-conjure it, you know?
Sure, yeah, totally.
And
yeah, there's not a lot of external frameworks that you can really tap into.
Yeah, and I wonder if I would struggle with that so often if I had grown up with faith and grown up mm-hmm. believing in higher power or something like that, you know? Like, it's hard to move through life believing in change, believing that I can be, like, part of change, and also having to, like, make up my own self-motivation every step of the way, every single day.
Totally.
And so having frameworks that feel like they support you, mm-hmm. and they give you a path forward when you can't carve your own seems really important.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Quaker hasn't been doing that for me lately. Mm. It's one of the things. I, like, don't know that I believe in God.
Sure.
I don't believe in God, but I'm, like, open. I'm open to finding something spiritual there, and yeah. I'm hoping that that's the case because I think there's, like, a lot to learn from Quakerism. I'm also, like I said, skeptical of the passive white liberal thing that I see going on.
Definitely.
Sometimes in those circles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess the performativity of like, goodness is satisfying to a lot of people, and maybe they're not very reflexive about it. I don't know, but I guess I haven't gone to any kind of religious meeting in a very long time, or anything that even has a spiritual bent, really, other than...
But I feel that in, like, certain, like, activist circles, you know, where it's just like, hey, and we're all gathering here, and we're planning this awesome thing, and it's really good, and it's like, hey, did you consider maybe who's not here in the room with you? Did you consider, like, maybe including some other people? Oh, but we're doing this thing, and it's really nice, and then we did the thing, and it's great, and we did it. And then people are like, hey, we had some problems with how you did that. And they're like, don't tell me I did it bad. I really tried and it made me feel so good to do it. So why are you making me feel bad? Not pointing any fingers at certain things that happened in Vancouver.
Okay. I'm just thinking, like, I definitely have been that person in the past, I mean, for sure.
Yeah, me too. Younger, trying to organize stuff and being kind of clueless, but, like... Mm-hmm. I don't know, different, there's been a lot of, like, marches and things like that in Vancouver, and some of them have missed the mark kind mm-hmm. of significantly, and then getting criticism and feedback has been really painful for a lot of the organizers and the people that are actually doing the, like, hey, we'd really like to help you do better next time, are like, why do I have to take care of your feelings so much while I also tell you this? So,
yeah.
Like, anyway.
Oof.
So, I think there's a lot of that. I think Vancouver has some... Because this was such a hotbed of, like, we're such, like, hippies, and we started Greenpeace in Vancouver, so, like, if we all come from that legacy, we're such activists, right? And it's like, but all the stuff that you used to do, you're not doing anymore. You're just, like, coasting on the fact that you used to do that kind of stuff. I don't know. That's maybe just, like, older folks that I interact with in different circles.
I've been seeing that a lot in Vancouver organizing, like, specifically in people's responses to, like, Black Lives Matter Vancouver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think Black Lives Matter Vancouver has done, like, an amazing job of coming forward with, like, specific, implementable
recommendations
basically any time I've seen them raising awareness about like lack of intersectionality and organizing practices. And it always seems like such reasonable demands. It's like, here's five demands, one of which is like have a black woman speak at this event, right? Like, it's just like it's one, they're asking for one person in your lineup. Like yeah. It's, and people's reactions are so often like, well, what am I even supposed to do about that? You know?
Like, yeah. It's like, they literally wrote you a roadmap. Like,
yeah, they did all the work. They
oh my God.
They wrote you a 5-step plan, and every step is a single sentence long, and you could do it all today.
Yeah.
God, and the I could talk all day about it, but that's just the weak, gruel, like, consistency of the, well, we're going to do this about the police request, which just, like, we'll just do cops light, diet cops, will be, like, at the Pride parades. Like, no armored service vehicles, but they can have their regular cars. Like, no, how about none of them there?
Yeah. I thought that was so weird. At National Aboriginal Day, I had a booth there with work, and, like, the cop tank was there, and it's just like, this seems like really
a terrible idea.
Yeah, like, and it's like the big tank was like pointing at basically like all the children's activity. Like, it was just like the where the stage where all the nice like music and stuff was happening, there's just also a tank in the field. And it was like so weaponized, and we see that like these tools, like tanks and stuff, are being deployed on Indigenous people in the States, like, ugh, right now as we're talking. Like, it's not just like an, oh, the cops are also here to show solidarity. Like, no.
I only recently been able to, like, because obviously I've come up in privilege my whole entire life. And so, like, being a person who is, you know, white, middle class, and, like, read pretty instantaneously as female, I seem like a pretty low threat to a police officer, so they've never given me trouble, right? So it's just only in the last few years I've been like, oh, that's not a universal experience somehow. It takes a while to understand sometimes, but yeah, I mean, it's, like, I saw the ACAB, All Cops Are Bastards. I thought it was assigned cop at birth, is how I read it at first. I'm like, oh, I've been in this other discourse for so long. That only, like, anti-fascism, anti-cop stuff, like, is so new to me. I'm just like, no, you're not born a cop. You chose to be a cop. Oh, Lord. Yeah. All cops are bastards. I'm afraid my family will hear this, because I do have an RCMP officer in my family, and I don't want to have a big conversation about it, but...
Well, I think, to that RCMP member who's in your family, I think that... I don't know. It's important to remember that people choose to be cops. Like, yeah, you said, totally. It's not like a born thing.
No.
And people continually choose every moment that they remain a cop to remain a cop.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that any one of those cops can choose to see what's happening in Standing Rock, what's happening in Ferguson, what's happening anytime that black or brown people congregate, and they can just stop choosing to be a cop.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that that's, like, going to be easy, because that family member probably has a mortgage.
Yeah.
And that family member might have kids.
Single income, 2 kids.
Mm-hmm. There you
living
go.
Living up north. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I don't want to pretend it's easy for that family member to stop being a cop, but they can at any point. At literally any moment of their life, they can choose to stop being a cop. And...
Nobody can choose to stop being brown or black or Indigenous to avoid cops.
Yeah. But maybe just your family member is listening to this and is just thinking in this exact moment right now about...
Give it a thought.
...choosing to not be a cop.
So.
So to switch topics, can I talk to you guys about bread?
Yeah, so that's... Because I was going to ask, so, like, you know, you're talking about your life philosophy and, like, you carving out motivation every day and figuring out, like, a way that you can create change yourself. And it's like, it feels like you have recently settled on... some really cool life goals that will sort of guide the way that you live and stuff like that.
Would you be willing to share your New Year's resolutions or your, what was the word you used for them? I can't remember.
I had New Year's resolutions.
Okay, yeah. No, I remember the list of them. I just can't remember if you called them resolutions, because I thought that they were fantastic and I'd love to hear them again.
Yeah, my New Year's resolutions this year are thicker skin, bigger heart, sharper claws, nobody goes hungry, and start right now.
I love it.
That's so awesome.
I just like tattoo that on the back of my eyelids. So yeah. I can see that every time I blink.
And for me, thicker skin is about a couple things. First of all, it's about the fact that I am, have been for the last year and a half healing from some like relational trauma. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the way that it manifested was in trying to make myself very, very small and trying not take up space. And anytime I took up space in a way that like rubbed someone the wrong way, I would like use that as evidence that I definitely should never take up any space or talk or like request anything of anybody.
Jeez, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. I wasn't actually good at that. I was still taking up plenty of space and I was still making requests of people, but I was just like just feeling shitty about it, you know? God. And so, thicker skin is about that. It's about being like willing to, take up the space that I require and ask for the things that I require and say what I'm excited about and say what I hope will happen in situations and understand that I might screw up along the way and there might be criticism or there might be like dialogue and that that's actually okay. That doesn't mean that I am like a bad person who is ruining everything I touch. It just means that I am learning and growing, which is actually the goal. It's not a bad thing. It's like the whole point.
So that, in other words, is that like a willingness to be uncomfortable in order to live a better and more engaged life?
Yeah. And also the willingness to like hear criticism and especially the willingness to like be proactive and take action, acknowledging that that might mean receiving criticism.
Yeah.
That like just making myself small and doing less and being less connected to people so that I don't ever face criticism isn't actually a good strategy for being happy or, like, affecting change in the world. You know, it doesn't actually make the world better for anyone.
Nope. Least of all you.
Least of all me, yeah.
You deserve to be just as much a part of the world that you're trying to make better.
Well, yeah. It's yours, too.
So thicker skin is about that, and it's also about just, like, not freaking out about stuff, you know, like,
totally.
Acknowledging that change is rough and uneven sometimes, and that's actually okay, and acknowledging that people have to, like, hash shit out, and that's actually okay. I don't know, bigger heart's about having a bigger heart. Sharper claws is, like, specifically about, like, anti-fascism and about resisting white supremacy and about confronting cops and about just, like, being willing to be ungentle with oppressors.
Yeah. That's great.
Nobody Goes Hungry is about wanting to feed all of my friends and also, like, look beyond that and be like, how can I feed people I haven't made friends with yet? How can I, like, make more friends by feeding more people? Like, how can I...
That's so awesome.
How can I address hunger?
I remember, like, one thing that you wrote one time was just like, oh, I made all these casseroles for a friend and I'm walking them over... And, like, I realize that this is the kind of person that I want to be. Like, I'm taking my baby for a walk while dropping off some food to another friend. Like, this is amazing.
Like, this like almost an adorable Midwestern-y mom kind of vibe, but it's also, like, radical, political, community building.
Yeah, I just
I'm just going to take these casseroles over with my baby, you know? Like, that's... It's cute. Yeah. It's so cute. And also really wonderful.
Yeah, and, like...
also very cute.
And, like, so important.
Yeah.
To people. So it's like, I wrote to you, I was having a hard time, and immediately you're like, I can make you 6 casseroles. Like, I'm actually well taken care of in that respect, but thank you very much.
I have no room in my freezer.
That's the way I see you taking care of people as well, Chris. Like, you're really good at showing up for people and being like, I can cook you food, and I can clean your house. And those are, like, I feel like so often people want to offer care to one another, and they think of that as being limited to, like, to listening, which is, like, listening is really, really important, but there's, like, there's not a willingness, I think, to, like, extend themselves and be, like, I will show up and provide for you materially. I will knock you upside the head when you're acting stupid. I will, like, I will do the things that need to happen in your life for you to be materially taken care of.
Yeah.
And I see you being really good at that.
One of the things that, like, yeah, I definitely do a lot of, like, cleaning for folks, and it's because I'm often... Like, I don't have the capacity to sit and listen, but I'm like, but I could put in a podcast and, like, do some chores at your house, and then it still is helping, but I don't really have the spoons to, like, sit and talk while you cry, even though, like, I would totally do that on any other day, but today I'm just gonna do this, like, tactical thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's, like, there's many different ways to help that doesn't, like, yeah. And then it kind of restores me a little bit more, because then I feel like I'm still getting my quiet alone time. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I found that that's a good, yeah. that, a good way that that's worked for me in the past, and we'll keep going on.
Yeah, finding better ways to help and to, like, stretch what you're normally good at with those things, I think, is a really awesome thing to do. And doing what you're capable of, instead of, like, not doing anything,
yeah.
mm-hmm. is really awesome.
And I think, yeah, like, picking your own strengths and, like, and providing care from a place of those strengths is, like, really important. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, like, the thing you're getting at a minute ago, but, like, life project stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I think while I was recovering from surgery, it was the same time that Trump had just been...
Let's just call him different, like, onomatopoeic sounds, like Trunk, Blamp, Drunk.
Well, Trump had just been elected, and so all of the time after his election and leading up to and through his inauguration, I was mostly just in bed, and I didn't have a lot of capacity, because I was in a lot of pain every day, and I was, like, just working to get through that and remain grounded. But since I was in bed all day, I was looking at Twitter all day, and since I was looking at Twitter all day, I was just encountering, yeah, exactly, like, new evidence of fascism taking deep root throughout this whole continent, was just, like, every single day, and I was thinking about all the things that I wish I could be doing, and all the things that I knew that I needed to be doing, and I was kind of, you know, I was adding to the list in my head of all the things that I need to be doing and I'm not yet doing, mm-hmm. and I think that, like, the list is, like, a specter that renders a lot of progressives unable to actually act.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, like...
These are all the things that I have to do, and then you're just paralyzed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, yeah, the way you do activism, it just, like, you constantly expand the list, and activism constantly gets harder, and you constantly know you need to do more, but you feel less and less capable of doing anything. And I think, like... I don't know. I think, like, websites like Everyday Feminism, you know, they're like 23 more things to add to the list, and there's a new article every day, and, like, I was just adding to the list for months and doing nothing else, mm-hmm. and I came out of that both feeling, like, fired up to do work because I had been unable to for so long, but also very daunted, mm-hmm. And, like, approaching a mobilization because just... The list was too many things for any human to contend with. Mm-hmm. But then I did LSD, which is a wonderful, wonderful cure for the list.
Sorry for that giant laugh, but it was just the fucking transition on that was so chef kissy fingers.
But okay, so here's the thing. I came through that journey. Like, thinking about the list and thinking about how, like, trying to work from the list, trying to solve the world by just considering all 15,000 things that you need to be doing, that you already need to have been doing the whole time and that you haven't been doing. It's just, like, a really bad way to start affecting change, I feel like. And the place that that I went to with the people I was with on that journey was to start thinking about, like, what is your project? And every article that I read while I was in bed over the last few months was, like, how do you fight fascism? How do you fight climate change and deregulation and the rise of white supremacy? Like, how do you fight all of these things, or the emboldening of white supremacy? Like, how do you fight all these things simultaneously? And every single time, like, an activist wrote an article about this, they were like, have a project. Have one thing that mm-hmm. you care about. And then just every day, care more deeply about it and do more about it and become more militant about protecting it. And so we were talking about that while on LSD, and my compatriot had said that seemed really good, but there's this problem with having one life project, which is that if it crashes and burns, then you're like, well, my life no longer has meaning.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's dangerous.
You got to diversify your portfolio.
Your care portfolio.
Both of you were immediately like, yup. Like, that's definitely happened to you. And that happened to me. That happened to me in 2015 with... Story games. Mm-hmm. It had been, like, my life project for a decade. And I stopped knowing how to care about it and knowing how to get value out of the work that I was putting into mm-hmm. it. And it was, like, paying rent, which I was really fortunate for, but it wasn't leaving me feeling empowered and directed in the world. Mm-hmm. So then we were like, cool, one life project, that's a terrible idea. Two life projects, that's perfect. That's a sweet spot right there. But I think that it is, because it allows you to be an expert in, like, you can definitely become an expert in two things.
For sure.
There's enough time in the day to do that. But it allows you to be the expert in this community that knows something about that community. You can be like, as a children's community facilitator who knows about beekeeping, I can cross-apply this knowledge in, like, a unique, special way, because mm-hmm. every other children's community facilitator, you know, knows about other weird shit. They're into whales. They're into violins. They're...
Whales that play violins.
Yeah, that, it's a deep, rich field.
Yes.
Violin-playing whales.
We all know that whales can only play the bassoon. The one instrument they
can
play. No,
their whale calls kind of sound like a violin a little bit.
That's true.
But we started talking a lot about, like, the power of the ampersand, the power of having projects and thinking about how you can cross-apply them and practicing cross-applying them, and then turning towards the world being like, okay, I've got my projects, and I'm just going to cross-apply them to everything that everyone else is doing. Like, you are doing a lot of work to, like, shut down pipelines. How can I use my project of free bread to support you? And, like, that's a great example, I think, because, like, a lot of... like, any social movement that has had, like, sustainability built into it has had a communal kitchen, like, yeah. operating at the heart, right? Like, the Black Panthers, like, early on established, like, a breakfast program for mm-hmm. children in their community. Mm-hmm. And, like, any, like, strike, any, like, large industrial strike, like a coal mine strike or something like that, if it is successful, it is in part successful because there was a communal kitchen that kept the picketers going, that brought people in to support them, that, mm-hmm. like, had families pooling their resources so they weren't struggling to feed themselves on less income mm-hmm. And having nothing to offset that,
yeah, that's
that,
good.
Right?
That empowers you to then be able to take the time off work that it needs to be able to, like, make a strike successful.
Yeah.
When I was doing labor studies a few years ago, there was this course I took called Women Workers and Farmers, and a big focus of that was on how like traditional trade unions and early industrial unions were largely successful in long prolonged strikes because of women's auxiliaries. And so the men would go to strike and they would pick at the mines, and the women's auxiliary would pool together and they would start making soup and they would start making bread. And I think that's inspiring knowledge to have mm-hmm. because it's like a reminder that you don't need to know how to hold a picket line and also cook for large groups of people and also do direct action. And also you need to have your projects mm-hmm. and you need to know how to cross apply them. And that's it.
That's awesome. So to go back, you mentioned free bread. That's one of your projects.
Free bread is one of my life projects. Yeah. Free bread and non-pathologizing therapy. Those are my two life projects that I've settled on.
Can you explain each of those in a little...
One's probably a little bit easier to explain.
Yeah, free bread, I, like,
free
understand.
Free bread, okay, no.
Yeah.
No,
free gonna... bread, bigger heart, those kinds of things are a little bit,
yeah.
you know.
I'm going to explain it anyway.
Yeah,
like explaining
please.
It? I'm
we
working,
like bread,
I'm
so...
working on the pitch. The pitch for free bread.
Pitch us, we're the dragon's den, obviously. The sea hag's den.
Yeah, I think that that thinking about, like, producing... nourishing staple foods for community is really important, because not only are you bringing people together and establishing community and making sure they're well nourished and helping people to, like, feel empowered in their bodies even when they are broke and even when they're, like, going through mental health issues and not able to cook, like, well-rounded meals for themselves, but you're also... I think if you're picking some staple foods and being like bread especially for me, but like bread, lasagna, there's a few others that I'm like, these are the things that I want to cook and I want to provide for my community. I'm now more able to start thinking about, like, how do I localize the work that I'm doing, the food work that I'm doing and, like, providing for my community. Mm-hmm. And, like, sourdough bread is what I've been doing. And that's, like, it's a really easy thing to start thinking about, like, localizing and start caring about production chains, because
I see.
It is just flour, salt, water. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been cooking my bread with, like, hemp seeds on the bottom, so there's this, like, seedy little layer to it.
Sorry, that sounds
everyone,
so good.
Everyone does that reaction.
It adds some, really, like, adds a little bit of fat and protein and stuff and just makes it more nutritious and more delicious.
Yeah, that's and there's, cool. like, a little bit of a texture thing going on. It's, everyone surprised with, like, seeds.
I just love sourdough so much. It's such a wonderful thing.
Monday night, 5:30 every week, we have community dinners, and you should just come over and eat bread.
Just eat that bread.
Yeah.
Nothing else. Just tear hunks of it off.
Yeah.
Also, there's other food to accompany the bread.
Nope, just bread.
Just bread.
Just bread forever. Great. I'm like an old-timey soldier. Just give me bread and water, and I'm happy. I'll swap the poop deck.
Katie and I talk about, like, how much we love making soups in, like, large batches, so it's like, that fits nicely with your bread project.
I'm a soup lesbian. I'm like, that's not true. A soup bisexual? No, I was just like, that's the thing that I could provide in a community kitchen is like a very wonderful, nourishing soup.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I also am really invested in the idea of providing care to activist communities because I'm not a frontline person.
Yeah,
I'm not good at confrontation. That's not a thing I'm good at, but I'm really good at, I think we share a number of facility? No, that's not the word I'm going for.
Faculty?
But faculties? I don't know. We have some similar strengths, I think. From what little I know of you, because we've only hung out a couple of times now, but I've been following you on the internet for a couple of years now. I think that I want to, like, recognize people's emotions, like, where they're at and stuff, and be able to just acknowledge them and say, like, hi, you're here, I'm seeing you, we're both people, that kind of thing. And just, like, taking care of other people really means a lot to me. But I can't go on the front and, like, yell in a cop's face. Like, I should because I have privilege that will protect me. That would be a helpful and useful thing, but I'm not there right now. So being able to support people who are good at doing that, great. If I can help them get up every day and do what they gotta do, like, I think that's something that I can do now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in the future I can be that, like, face up at the front and be scared and just live with that and be there. But right now I really like the idea of creating nurturing spaces for other people. So I love that you do that. I think it's really wonderful.
No, and I'm reflecting again on saying, like, any sustainable movement has that kitchen at the heart of it is, like, a really important thing to remember.
Turns
so it's, like, actually a super valuable thing to have. And so it's not just, I'm just doing this thing. It's like, no, it's actually a central tenet that will actually let us, like, keep doing
devaluing
this,
feminized labor in ourselves is easy to do.
That's real.
But it's actually, like, for especially, like, a militant protest to last longer than, like, 10 hours.
Yeah.
Either you need food there or people need to be leaving constantly to go eat. And for a picket line to run for weeks and weeks and weeks, like, that means families are running on, like, a cut income because they're, like, just running off the strike fund, which is not going to be as much as full wages. And they're, you know, they're having to do more with less.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, pooling resources, creating communal kitchens, putting those kitchens as close to the front line as possible, like, sustains movements and drives action.
So cool. Definitely.
So I've been thinking a lot about those kinds of things, thinking about how you build activism from a place of strengths, from a place of, like, I can contribute. Bread and therapy. These are the things that I've got them down. And how can I just cross-apply them? How can I apply free bread to as many problems as possible?
Mm-hmm.
How can I apply, like, non-pathologizing therapy to as many problems and locations of problematization as possible?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how can I be a frontline crisis therapist? How can I do these kinds of things? And how can I do them in, like, a radical, transformative, liberatory way?
Mm. Can you explain non-pathologizing therapy a little bit?
Yeah, I'm super excited about it.
Can.
Yeah, that's the other thing. That's the other thing that that's the other, like, idea that I'm riding the wave of coming out of that LSD trip is just, like, when you have life projects, part of it is just, like, being so earnest about them and being so, yes, I'm very excited to tell you about this. just going as deep in to.
Yeah.
Unbashfulness as you possibly can with those life projects.
Oh, that's
enthusiasm
so cool.
is a very attractive trait, I think,
mm-hmm.
in people.
It's hard to sustain in Vancouver sometimes.
It is, yeah, we are post-irony, dry, sarcastic. God forbid you're ever excited about anything here.
Yeah. I want to talk about non-pathologizing therapy in a second, but I want to respond to that. First, when I went to Sweden, to Malmo, a few years ago to give a talk for their Pride about role-playing games. And when I was there, like, I was surrounded by, like, a bunch of, like, politicized queers. And when they talked about their politics, it was such an unfamiliar, like, language. They were talking in English, but, like, it was such unfamiliar ways of talking to me. Because they were like, I am a Marxist. My friend is a liberatory anarchist. My friend is a liberatory anarchist and also a feminist. And they were just, like, every time they talked about really anything in politics or anything in social movements, they're using, like, the capital letter version, and they weren't equivocating, and they weren't trying to undercut whatever they said. Mm. They weren't like, I am a feminist, though obviously I have problems with feminism, like, for example, this and this and this and this, right. and this, and I struggle with it. And, like, I think that the people in Vancouver are very quick to try and distance themselves from any earnest relationship to anything, but especially to like, political projects.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, it seems like having, like, that critical, reflexive, like, ability to, like, self-interrogate your own projects is very vital and very important, and developing, like, greater intersectional awareness is super important.
But when you're talking about them to others, to have a lot more, like, just unequivocal...
Yeah, like, it just seems like, talking about the things that you care about as if you didn't care about them doesn't seem like a great strategy. You know? It just...
No, you're totally just right.
Just being, like, pissy and blasé about the things that you think are going to change the world doesn't position them to change the world well.
I guess it's almost like it has some self-defeating aspects built into it, right? Because you're like, I don't think this is going to work, so I don't want anybody to think that I'm super invested in it, because when it falls apart, then I won't be so sad or something. Like, I do that with interpersonal relationships, or have in the past, like with romantic relationships. Like, well, I don't want to get too invested in this, because when it falls apart, I'll be really sad. But, like, then you don't have a full relationship. And I think that that's applicable in a lot of different spaces and places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that challenging the things you love is important, and that's how you make them better.
Yep.
But I think that doing that in a way that erodes your love for them seems like maybe the wrong approach to just start from a default with, you know?
Yeah,
totally.
And so I've been working to be just, like, really, like, earnest and excited to talk about my life projects.
Awesome.
The joke in my house is, like, have you heard about bread?
Have you heard the good news?
Because I think that people should just be sincerely excited about the things that they can provide to the world. So that others can be excited about receiving those gifts. And excited about talking about their own projects. And excited about finding their own projects and finding their own strengths. And naming them and claiming them and, like, celebrating them. Because so, I don't think that we're going to, like... I don't think the revolution works if everyone is, like... milquetoast about their own contributions to it, you know? Like,
yeah, I do. I was just the word I was just like, fuck, I am that thing. I'm so milquetoast.
Cool, well, call out.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good self interrogation, and I'm just like, give me some sourdough toast and milk. I'm just hungry. This is all that's happening right now.
Oh man.
But yeah, so non-pathologizing therapy, what I mean by that is, right now, what I most immediately mean by that is narrative therapy, which is the kind of therapy that I am training to become a therapist in.
I love narrative therapy so much.
And narrative therapy is great. It starts from the place of, like, throwing the DSM into the fire.
Where it belongs.
And then saying, what if people knew about their own bodies and knew about their own brains and actually deserved the storytelling rights to what's going on in their own lives? What if we started from that premise? What if we empowered people to tell stories about their own lives and claim those stories as their own? And what if we empowered people to, like, look at the problem stories that they're telling, find clues that there's other stories possible, and just start telling those ones instead? And I think narrative therapy is, like, it's interesting because it's often, like, focusing on someone telling a story about, like, why their relationship doesn't work anymore, right? Or, like, why they are secretly a bad person, or why they are pathetic because they put up with abuse in an abusive relationship. And for that example, it's the therapeutic process is about looking at how they behaved in that abusive relationship and asking, like, when did you start telling yourself the story that you're pathetic in that situation? Mm-hmm. What are some counterexamples? Oh, cool. So there is the possibility to tell a different story. We could tell a story about how you were actually really resilient, about how you protected your heart, about how you made strategic choices, about how you are out of it now. And, like, how can we look to that and we can build a story about how you got out? Mm-hmm. How can we tell a story about how you resisted in the ways that were strategic and safe to you moment to moment? And how can we see that as a source of strength?
Yeah, I think it's so cool. There's a lot of, in narrative therapy, looking at, like, where did you learn that from? Like, when it's like, oh, well, I'm not allowed to do blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, okay. Like, and in a very non-judgmental, like, very curious interview style, you go, where did you learn that from? Oh, well, I guess, you know, my dad told me blah, 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 this and that. And it's like, okay, well, is it possible that, like, he might have learned that from somewhere else and kind of tracing that backwards? Mm-hmm. Like, is that necessarily true? Or, like, can you, again, yeah, find some other times that, like, you didn't do that?
Like, unpicking things that we think are objective truths in our own lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or things that are fixed.
It's like it's definitely like a post-structural tradition in mm-hmm. that it's acknowledging that there can be many truths, there can be many stories. Mm-hmm. And it draws a lot on, like, pragmatism. And, like, especially, like capital P pragmatism, like the Scottish school of philosophical thought that is about looking at, like, what works. Because if it works, it's true.
That's so Scottish.
I love it.
Successively Scottish.
Yeah.
Love the Scots.
I've done more, like, traditional psychology training a little bit as mm-hmm. well, and, like, including history of psych stuff. And
lots of stuff about pathology there.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. But there's this, like, discourse that goes for years and years, centuries, about rationalism and empiricism and, like, mm-hmm. do you know things by developing, like, provable frameworks and then filling in the gaps, or do you know things by, like, having experiences and then building frameworks around them? Mm-hmm. And then, like, Scottish pragmatism comes in and it's like, like, who cares? Like, why are you talking?
What if, like, it's none of them?
Why don't we do the things that work? Because if something works, it's true. That's just what truth is. Can we stop talking about this now? Like, it's
I love it.
It's extremely, extremely
You're
Scottish.
Just thinking about people in your life that you know.
That are Scottish? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
Just, like, yep.
That's awesome.
But there was this one therapist before narrative therapy was, like, established as a specific practice. There was this one therapist whose name I cannot remember right now, but he had this type of therapy called role therapy, where you would talk about your problem with him, and then he would be like, what kind of person could, like, solve this problem? Like, for example, could a pirate solve this problem? And you're like, yes, a pirate would have no trouble solving this problem. Like, I can't solve this problem, but obviously a pirate could. And then he'd be like, cool, for the next 2 weeks, your job is to be a pirate. And not, like, pretend to be a pirate. And not, like, do pirate things. Your job is to be a pirate. And when you come back, you're going to have solved that problem, probably, because pirates can solve this problem, and you are a pirate. Great, good session. And you come back the next week, and be like, great, so pirates probably couldn't solve this new problem you have. And you're like, no. And he's like, what kind of person could solve it? And you're like, well, I don't know, like, definitely not me, definitely not a pirate, like, maybe an astronaut could? And he's like, great, you're an astronaut.
Go to space, asshole.
But the weird thing is, like, this works. This works over and over and over again. And part of the reason it works is that people believing that they have the power to solve a problem is just actually part of what it takes to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And especially when it's, like, psychological, someone telling you, like, someone pointing out that you already have all the tools to mm-hmm. solve something is just, like, it's huge, it's pivotal.
Yeah.
And I think, like, traditional psychology and psychiatry tells stories about how you are a subject that needs to be classified and fixed by an external expert who has language and tools and vocabulary that you don't.
Right.
And that you are broken and that you have an illness.
Yeah.
That you are sick and that you can't possibly understand the sickness because part of the sickness is not understanding it. And
mm-hmm. yeah, that's like very traditional psychology.
And I think that, like, probably that model helps some people sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes people just want to give over power to someone else who can be like, great, you're fixed. I solved you with these pills. And, like, I don't want to doubt that that can just, like, legitimately be helpful for some people. Mm-hmm. But, like, narrative therapy starts in this interesting place of, like, somewhere in you, there is the story about how you are good enough and whole enough and unbroken enough and powerful enough to overcome this. And right now, your life is being guided by this story that's harmful to you. Mm-hmm. And you built this story because you live in a world where oppression exists. Mm-hmm. And it's oppressive very, forces told you to build this story.
Yeah, it's very, very good at looking at, like, a lot of structural stuff where it's, like, it's not you. It's, like, again, that, like, where did you learn this? It's, like, from culture or, you know. And it's, like, I really like part of it where you're sort of taking your problem that you have and externalizing it a little bit so that you can have a conversation with it. So it's like, oh, me and my anxiety, like my I'm not an anxious person. I have a relationship with my anxiety and it can kind of like, my anxiety's telling me this right now. And you can kind of, it helps you.
And that cool. process specifically is called like externalization, where you take the problem and transform it from a thing that's inherently you and it's inside you to being something that you have a relationship with.
Right.
And I think that's like really powerful. When I went into narrative therapy as a client, I was talking a lot about feeling like I don't have the capacity to do all the things that a normal person ought to be able to do in a day, like cook for myself and clean and get out of bed at a certain time and all of these things like together I just like didn't feel capable of. And I got asked questions like, when did you learn that you should be capable of these things? And we started externalizing these things. We asked like unique questions to pull out where this came from. And we externalized it. And we talked about like, if you could name this force in your life that's telling you you ought to be able to do all these things, like what would you name it? And some people are like, I'm going to name it like the Spectre. And they give it like like badass epic names. And some people are like Dorothy. and so that character was Jack. And then... And we talked about Jack, and we imagined, like, what Jack would look like if Jack was, like, a person. And then the therapist was like, where does Jack live? And I was like, yeah, definitely, like, in my bedroom. And she was like, did you invite Jack to live in your bedroom? We talked about when Jack had arrived in my life. We talked about the fact that he lived in my bedroom. And then she asked me, like, did you invite him to be there? And I was like, no, definitely not. He just showed up one day and hasn't left. He's just in my bedroom.
He's not paying rent.
Exactly. He's not paying rent. He didn't ask. He doesn't have any stuff there. That's all my stuff.
Sort of a dick. He's kind of a dick. He's a terrible roommate. Never does the dishes.
And just tells me that I should be doing them instead and feel bad about it.
What nerve, Jack. But it was actually, like, really empowering to, like, to realize that, like, it wasn't that I was broken. It's that this figure had shown up and moved into my bedroom without asking me and was just there all the time talking shit. Mm-hmm. And, like, the fact that, like, I had instinctively gone and given this, like, a masculine name. Like, I had created a able-bodied white man and he sat in the corner of my room and didn't understand oppression and didn't understand chronic illness and didn't understand... like, what it's like to be a queer trans woman, what it's like to be chronically ill. And he just talks shit, as if everyone ought to be able to do the things that he's able to do. And it just felt so liberating to get to, like, ask Jack to please leave my room. Like, he needs to find his own place to live, you know? And, like, that was
Jack,
just...
Jack, you don't even like me, why are you here? Yeah, and the fact that it's, like, if like, a friend of yours was shit-talking you like that, you would, like, stand up for yourself. Or if that person, if, like... Jack was talking shit to Katie like that, you would be like, Jack, don't talk to her
if
like
I
that.
Saw,
I care about
if I
her.
Saw this random dude named Jack move into Katie's bedroom and just start shit talking constantly, I would do something about
exactly.
that.
Yeah. So, you know, why can't you do that for yourself kind of thing? Or like, or how can you do that for yourself, rather, is a much nicer question.
Well, I think that's a helpful thing to help people understand externalization. Is like, well, what if this was happening to somebody else? Because sometimes you can't see yourself as a person. Like, you just see yourself as the milieu that you're inside all the time, right? Like, it's just sometimes you feel like your environment as well as your actor, I find. And sometimes that can be really tough. So to have somebody give you that structure is really helpful. Really helpful.
And I think the cool thing about that, too, is externalizing that and having not just be a part of myself that I didn't like, but rather this like external figure that I could call upon or not call upon. It gave us the power to start asking questions like, when do I want Jack around? Because there are totally times when Jack's really useful. I'm like really good at moving. Because I've moved. House? Yeah. Because I've moved a lot. Because I'm not the most stable person in the whole world. But
that's okay.
But having Jack like show up every time and have, you know, because like, I'm good at just like hefting furniture single-handedly, and I'm good at doing like the Tetris, like the dad superpower of figuring out how to pack everything into the moving van all at once. And part of that is that like I have Jack like just like riding me on those days, and that's actually a great time when to have him there. On a
super deadline, sometimes it's good to have Jack around.
And so like getting to realize that like I didn't actually want that out of my life altogether. I just wanted to have a relationship where I could call that force up when I need it.
Yeah. He can come over, but he doesn't get to live there.
Exactly. Yeah. Super great friend to have on moving day.
Totally. And so that is even useful if you look at Jack as if Jack were a true, real person. Because like some of us have those friends in our lives where we're like, you're not good for me all the time, but I don't like want to cut you off either. Like there are things you can give to each other and get from each other that are still really good. It's just knowing how to have relationships with all kinds of different people. And I think narrative therapy probably helps with that too.
And the interesting thing is like Jack is like entirely a work of fiction, right? But the idea that I ought to be able to do all these things in a given day because normal people do it is also a fiction. And narrative therapy is about being like, listen, it's all made up. We made this shit up.
Everything is not
working
up
for us. It's all made up. Make up other shit.
It's all made up, guys. It's all made up.
So what I want to do with my life is bake bread for as many people as I can and offer non-pathologizing therapy that's like, hey, you're not broken. We just need to tell better stories.
That's so good.
I love this episode so much.
Can I talk about my narrative therapy experience? So I got roped into playing at the narrative therapy conference every year by a friend of mine. And so I played cello in the morning before the keynote speeches for like a couple of years in a row. And in exchange, I got to go to the workshops, which was so amazing. Mm-hmm. So like I learned about like using narrative therapy and like how to develop policy, which was really cool, where it was like they did it in the WASC Center of Dialogue where it's like rings.
Oh, in downtown?
Downtown. So a bunch of like folks with like lived experience and mental health issues would talk. There was a team of narrative therapists in the middle and then all these like doctors and policymakers around the outside. So then the like people were allowed to tell their experiences of like really bad experiences with like getting mental health treatment or whatever. The narrative therapist would kind of reflect and like go through that process with the person while the doctors all listened. And then the doctors then also told their story and their point of view of how they've been and whatever pressures they're under and their own structural things that they're dealing with. And the narrative therapist kind of did that work with them, and then everyone kind of got to talk together and see each other's, and they came up collectively with a bunch of recommendations for like improving mental health services, which I think is so super cool. And so I'm like, I kind of would like to eventually do that kind of work. And so I'm on my path to that kind of stuff by learning right now about like how political systems work now so that I can better help people navigate them. That's kind of my job right now. But in my own personal life, I went to, they always have like really good letter writing workshops and they have really good like relationship workshops where the people actually show like a transcript of a therapy session and you get to follow along with the transcript and watch the video and like actually see like the questions that were asked. And I found myself really like resisting a lot of the relationship stuff because I'm like, well, me and my partner, and this is before we were living together, we're two very separate people and that's good and we like that. And so if we were to like merge anything together, we'd lose all of our independence, so we just stay separate. And they're kind of like, okay, well, like, where did you learn that story? Like, this is somebody else was kind of talking about this, and I was just listening. And they're saying, like, your relationship could also be an externalized thing. So there's you, there's your partner, and then there's your relationship as a third thing. And so then instead of being like, oh, how do I give love to my partner? It's like, how do you nourish your relationship? You know? So it's like, you don't necessarily have to, because I'm always worried, it's like, oh, we're going to be codependent if we're like, I'm always thinking about your needs and always this when not prioritizing my own kind of thing.
Right.
But it's like, how about instead prioritize that relationship that's like the thing that you guys combine together and you both have to put equal work into it. So it's not about you taking care of that person. It's about you both taking care of that relationship. And it kind of blew my mind because I was like, then I'm still able to keep my own separateness. But then this is our teamwork right here. That's like really important to me as well. So then we're able to like,
that's super cool.
Navigate a bunch of those things.
I love it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, please. Okay.
That's adorable. I love it. No, you talk.
So no, Steven Universe.
Yes, I'm Steven, here.
Steven Universe. Yeah. I read this article where Rebecca Sugar, one of the show creators, or the show creator, was talking about goals behind making this show. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was said was, like, my goal with this show was to create an action show for kids, like, and especially for young boys, where a relationship was as exciting a thing to point to and like, imagine and talk about as a fight.
Yeah.
Because if you can do that, then, like, there's so much potential for, like, healing and, like, empowering a young generation of future men, in most cases, to, like, care about relationships and think of them as, like, cool, powerful, awesome things that let you do more than you could possibly do alone. Mm-hmm. And, like, that would be really nice for the world if more men thought that.
Very nice
for the world. And so I think, like, it's an interesting show where, like, the fusions when I need to, like, gems, like, come together and are like, now we're this awesome superpowered thing with this new weapon and cool shoulder pads.
Yeah.
It's, like, a really... it's a really cool way of, like, making tangible the thing that you were just talking about, mm-hmm. right? The idea that it's not just, like... That our relationship can be its own entity that you can, like, care about and value and ask, like, what do we want this to look like?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of cool weapons and outfits do we want this relationship to wear?
Yeah. What color do we want his gloves to be? Really yeah. important questions.
It's very important. I actually had gem artwork made for me and my wife. Aww. So we each have our own gem sonas and then our fusion together. Our fusion is Azurite, if you're curious.
I definitely was curious.
Yeah, I am Labradorite, Tessa was Watermelon Tourmaline, and together we were Azurite.
Watermelon Tourmaline's a really good name
yeah.
for a character.
I'll show you the pictures after. They're very cute. They're so cute,
I love them. Were they done by the same artist that did our...
Who else would I commission?
Yeah.
Other than Luna, who I yes. love dearly and is part of the school of Scottish pragmatism.
Pretty much.
Pretty much she is. I really love... Well, okay, the thing that I wanted to say just real quick was just that this has made me reconsider my decision to not go back and get my degree, like my master's degree in therapy, because mm-hmm. I had done all of the undergraduate work to go on and do an MEd or an MA in counseling psychology, basically. Because I'm very interested... In narrative therapy, I was always kind of like a bit of an Adlerian. Alfred Adler was actually a fairly early counselor. I don't think very long after the like Freudian Jungian school, mm-hmm. or maybe even a contemporary.
He's a contemporary of them. He was in like Freud's Wednesday circle initially. Right.
But, like, so many of the principles that he sort of founded his own school of therapy on are still used a lot today mm-hmm. because they were very person-centric. They did have aspects of narrative therapy in them. And I really enjoyed that stuff. But just, like, talking about it, I guess I just convinced myself over time, like, that I would be too sensitive to be a therapist, mm-hmm. which is possibly true. But also that's an important thing for a therapist to have, is to be sensitive to other people's needs and whatnot. But I thought that I would take on too much and absorb too much from other people. And that is still a concern. But I don't know, this whole conversation has made me think, like, maybe that is my contribution, because I don't have an idea of what I want to do as a career right now. Like, right now I am just making things and doing work that will support me to give me enough time and money to make the things I like to make. Because the things I like to make don't get paid for. Mm-hmm. Like, I do make money occasionally doing comedy, but I'm not going to make, like, enough to contribute meaningfully to my household. Mm-hmm. So I can't just, like, quit and do that. And same with writing. Like, I don't expect to be making a shit ton of money doing writing right now. So I'm like, what do I want to do? So this is, like, re-emerging as a possibility for me mm-hmm. because of this episode, I think. Mm-hmm.
Do you know about the Adler Institute in Vancouver?
Yeah.
I looked into that quite a bit.
It's private, though, so it's very expensive.
It's, mm-hmm. like, $50,000 for a two-year master's program, which I definitely, I thought about for a while, but just realized that, like, doing that would mean that I would have to charge more for therapy.
Yeah.
Coming out of that program that I want to. Like, I really want to be a force for, like, low barrier, accessible therapy.
Yeah.
And a $50,000 grad school program doesn't position me well for that.
No, no. I think the only way I would really do it now is if I could do it with, like, almost full funding.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I feel like there are things that I have done that would, there are things I've done, everybody, just so you know, I have done things. horrible things.
You've lived a full, rich life so far?
Yeah, so far that I think I could potentially get some, like, graduate funding, but also, like, grad school sounds like a horrible idea.
I mean, it sounds horrible to me, too. I'm not going to grad school.
You're going to do some of the programs at, like, the Narrative Therapy Institute?
Yeah, so I'm doing the 5-day intensive certification program through the Vancouver School of Narrative Therapy. I'm going again to the Therapeutic Conversations Conference. I'm doing a lot of self-educating. I've got a bachelor's degree with a bunch of psychology-type stuff in there, as well as, like, labor studies and, like, kind of, like, oppression theory stuff worked in there. Mm-hmm. And I'm pursuing... fingers crossed, opportunities for practicum placements.
Cool.
Because I think practicums are super important. I think mentorship is super important.
Big time.
But I've basically just, like, committed myself to figuring out how to become a competent, qualified therapist without going to grad school. Because academia just, like...
Yeah. It kind of sucks a lot of the, like... Not only, like, your energy, but then you get stuck sometimes in these structures that aren't actually helpful to the work that you want to do, and it, like, puts you in kind of a bad headspace and reinforces some shitty ideas.
I work with grad students a lot, so I know I don't want to be one right now. Like, really, really clearly, I don't want to be one right now.
I dropped out of my bachelor 7 times. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so painful to get through it. I think
congratulations on doing it, though.
I'm wrapping up final course, but then I'm done. So fingers crossed that I can get through this. I can.
Yeah,
I can always get through, like, 2 semesters before dropping out.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an atypical approach, honestly. No. I was going to say, like, you are among good friends.
I have a friend in Metamore who's been working on a zine for a while called How to Survive Your 7th Year of Your Undergrad.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, it's definitely not.
I think it took me about 8 years to do mine. I took, like, a big, long break in the middle.
If you truly count all of my schooling and the big break in between, took me 11 years. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I started at Kwantlen, and then I came back when I was 25 to SFU, and then finished when I was 29. Mm-hmm. So it took me a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in good company.
Yeah, this is totally reassuring. Good company.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, definitely becoming a therapist, for me, needs to mean not working through a grad school program.
I think that's great.
It needs to mean, like, intensive training and hands-on training and self-directed training and curiosity-led training and practicums and mentorships and, like, coffees with people who I want to learn from. And it needs to not involve committing myself to, like, 24-plus months grind.
And then my question always is, like... going back to the Scottish pragmatist, like, whatever, where it's just, like, what would work, like, in terms of certification and, like, credentials? Like, is that something that's important to us, like, have those credentials or to just be able to do the work? Like, do you need the credentials in order to, like, for example, take people's insurance or whatever? Like, so that's important to, like, get those certifications. Yeah, I mean, but, like, what other...
Yeah, so the thing that was...
I don't know if that's helpful or interesting, but I think about that, like, if you're not going to, like, school or, like, grad school, like, what other ways can you put together, like, the credentials that you would need to...
A thing that was interesting for me to learn a few years ago is that both therapist and counselor are not protected titles in British Columbia, which means that anyone can just be, like...
It's like being a doula. That's why... That's what I was thinking of, because I did my, like, weekend doula program, and then I'm like, well, I'm a doula now. I've never done anything with this before, and it took, like, a lot of practicum and, like, just working in the job and just doing the job, you know.
Well, part of doula licensing what's the largest body?
The DONA or whatever.
DONA.
But that's, like...
Part of their licensing, though, even, is having been a doula already for 3 births. So the entire licensing process is, like, first you have to do a bunch of work unlicensed.
And it's not licensed. Which is interesting. It's not even licensing at all. You can still practice without it. It's just literally, you get to put these credentials on your name to say that there is, like, a... set of ethics and standards that I have been trained under. Yeah. And that's all. It's just like the College of Counselors, like, in British Columbia. Yeah. It's like, these are our practice standards.
You can get an RCC, but it doesn't guarantee anything for you. Like, like, most people's insurance won't pay for a registered clinical counselor.
Most people's insurance doesn't pay for any kind of counseling support at all. So it's like,
very true.
Hopefully that'll change.
Very true.
Like,
yeah, I pay out of pocket.
Yeah.
My goal personally is to, like, be doing low barrier, low cost narrative therapy, especially for trans and queer community. And I'm that means I'm dealing with a segment of the population who mostly don't have stable jobs mm-hmm. that have stable and expansive benefits. Exactly. So I actually don't need to worry about whether I'm going to be covered by someone's insurance because they won't have it.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah.
So.
No, I think that's really awesome. I like the idea.
But that frees you up a little bit to then come at the work through different methods.
And to come at it from what will be best for my learning, what will make me the most skilled and empowered practitioner possible, and what will help me to provide that therapy in a low barrier way.
Awesome.
So, yeah, that's the life project, that and bread.
Can we end it right there?
Sure.
I just thought that was so perfect. Avery, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
This was an excellent episode, and I feel very energized in my heart.
Yay, good.
Which is bigger now, somehow. Yeah. Your goals have been
you
transformed into me.
You came into this, quite tired, and now you're just, buzzing.
I'm beaming.
That's great.
Yeah. I'm beaming.
Let's go to a party.
Just like, that's like my Oprah thing. I love bread!
It's because I was like, have you heard of bread?
Have you heard about bread? It's me, Oprah. Did you know I love bread? You told us already, Oprah. Yeah. Have some bread.
Can we plug your game? Your new game that, or it's re-release, come back out? Is that Monster Hearts?
Yeah.
How can people get that? So it's an awesome story game?
Yeah, Monster Hearts 2 is the project that I'm currently working on with Story Games. I had, quit Story Games for a while, but have returned to it. And it's currently available on pre-order. It's a game about teenagers who are secretly monsters, which is definitely probably in most cases a metaphor for experiences of queerness and marginalization and otherness. It's a game of teenage vampires and werewolves having dysfunctional relationships, and it's available for pre-order. And it's available for pre-order on my website, which is buriedwithoutceremony.com.
We'll put a link.
We will put a link.
Thank you so much for being our guest today. Yay. You're lovely, and I love talking to you.
We'll have to have you back sometime.